From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the rise and fall of the mob in Las Vegas. We talk with journalist Nicholas Pileggi, author of the new book Casino. He also co-wrote the screenplay for Martin Scorsese's new film Casino, which opens later this fall, starring Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci, and Sharon Stone. Scorsese's film Goodfellas was based on Pileggi's bestseller Wise Guy. Also today, film music. Kevin Whitehead reviews a new box set of music by Italian composer Ennio Morricone. He wrote the scores for over 200 films, including Sergio Leone's Spaghetti Westerns. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Martin Scorsese's new film, Casino, which will be released later this fall, is the story of Las Vegas and the mob in the 70s. The screenplay was co-written by Scorsese and my guest, Nicholas Pileggi. Pileggi also wrote the new nonfiction book, Casino. He's a journalist who has written about organized crime for much of his career. His bestseller, Wise Guy, about life in the lower echelon of the mafia, was the basis of Martin Scorsese's film, Goodfellas. Two stars of that film, Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci, also star in Casino, along with Sharon Stone. The book Casino centers around Frank Lefty Rosenthal, who came to Vegas in 1969 and became one of the most powerful and controversial men in the city. Pileggi says Rosenthal had dodged trouble most of his life, since his days as a teenager when he was a clerk and bookie for Chicago gamblers and mobsters. In Vegas, he ran four casinos.
He was running these casinos, which turned out to be run and owned and controlled, more than owned, by the mob. And he decided to become legitimate, in a sense. He decided to take over some casinos and run some casinos, and he got to take them over. The men who gave him this power turned out to be organized crime men. And the story hinges upon his running these casinos, his boyhood friend, a fellow by the name of Anthony Spilotro, going to Las Vegas at the behest of the mob and running the muscle in Las Vegas for the mob. It's taking care of any disputes. He was a kind of vicious guy. The FBI told me he had at least 26 murders attached to his little record. And
Tony Spilotro.
Tony Spilotro.
Tony the Ant.
Tony the Ant is what they call him. And while Lefty was in Las Vegas, he fell in love. He fell in love with a fabulous-looking showgirl by the name of Jerry McGee. And after many, many years of living a kind of obsessional gambler's life, he now was running casinos. He was working in a casino, and his wife said, "Why don't we, in a sense, go for a straight life?" And that's what they did. He became one of the most innovative and brilliant casino managers in the country. He was the first man to figure out that if we had women blackjack dealers in strip casinos, it would just make it a lot happier place. And he was the first man to hire women as casino dealers in blackjack on the strip. He was the first man to bring the sports betting into the casinos. Until Lefty Rosenthal, there wasn't one sports betting operation in a casino. They were all on side streets. And he's also the man who was brilliant enough to have seen Siegfried and Roy and hired them away from the place they were, built them a stage, and helped create Siegfried and Roy as the most phenomenal showbiz group there is, a sort of showbiz act there is in Las Vegas. So he was an exceptional man in addition to his gambling talents. Unfortunately, it all went to his head. It all went to all of their heads.
Well, let me back up a little bit. This is a kind of obvious question, but why was Vegas such an attractive place for the mob?
Because it was the only place in the United States where there was legitimate gambling. Only state where you can legitimately gamble. Frank Rosenthal said to me, "I was illegitimate in every state in the Union except Nevada." In Nevada, he said, "I could walk down the street, I could take numbers, I could gamble, I could bet on horses, I could do anything I wanted that way in the state of Nevada." He said the same things. If I were doing the same things in Miami, they'd arrest me as a bookmaker.
Now, Frank Lefty Rosenthal gets to Vegas in, what, 68, 69? Mm-hmm. What was Vegas like when he got there?
Well, it was a fascinating place at the time. It was a city where the casinos overwhelmingly were run by the mob. And the reason that had happened was that when Las Vegas casinos began to explode, and they began in the 50s when they began really building these places, two things had happened that created Las Vegas, and neither of them had anything to do with the mob or anything. First thing that happened was after the Second World War, in the beginning of the 1950s, airplanes arrived in American culture. You could take a plane and go almost nonstop from New York to Las Vegas. You couldn't do that before the Second World War, before they figured out that the Air Force was an important element. And the second thing that happened that created Las Vegas was the Carrier Air Conditioning Company figured out how to air condition a huge area. Until then, they could air condition your room, but when you went down and gambled, it was 110 degrees. The Carrier Air Conditioning Company figured out in the 50s, late 40s, early 50s, how to air condition a vast room. And those two elements, and the fact that Las Vegas and Nevada, the state of Nevada, gambling was legal, allowed lots of men who had illegal gambling casinos on the outskirts of America's cities, the Phoenix City kind of place, colonial clubs outside of Miami, the Jockey Club in Saratoga. These illegal gambling dens were always under pressure and corruption from corrupt political people. These men said, why go on with this? Let's go to Vegas where we can open legitimate places. And that's exactly what they did.
So when Rosenthal gets there in the late 60s, how much of Vegas was controlled by the mob?
Almost all of it. All of the big casinos, all of the new casinos. The old, let's call them cowboy casinos. Binion's, Horseshoe, The Last Frontier, the places that had a basic Western theme to them. You've seen those casinos where you've got a cowboy with his hat is off and he's clicking his heels because he's just won $2 trillion betting on Keno. Those Western casinos with sawdust on the floor and Yahoo kind of spirit to them, they were the original casinos from Nevada. When the estimable Benjamin Siegel arrived, he had nothing to do with Western casinos. Benny Siegel, some people call him Bugsy Siegel, he created the Eastern or organized crime notion of the casino. And what was it? It was literally to recreate the Fontainebleau Hotel from Miami Beach in the middle of the desert. So the early casinos, if you look at the early pictures of the Fontainebleau, it's literally, I mean, the early pictures of the Flamingo, Benny's Flamingo, it literally is built in such a way that it overlooks the ocean. I mean, he literally took the blueprint for an oceanside hotel and put it in the middle of the desert. That's how much foresight they put into it. And yet it worked. It was a glamorous place. There were no cowboy hats around the place. People showed up in tuxedos. And that was the beginning of the Eastern influence in Las Vegas.
So in the late 60s, when Lefty gets to Vegas, are there Sheratons and Hiltons and chain hotels there yet?
Not yet. The law in Las Vegas was written in an interesting way. Public corporations could not invest in casinos. The licensing laws were so stringent that public corporations could never go through the onerous task of having every one of the people with an interest in that corporation licensed. So public corporations couldn't invest. Banking establishment, for the most part, would not invest on moral grounds. They felt gambling was illegal. They often had clergymen on their boards of directors, and they just morally would not invest. And the only place in the 50s and 60s where anyone looking to start a casino had to go for money, the only place where there was enough money to lend you those millions, were the International Brotherhood of Teamsters Central States Pension Fund. In the 50s and 60s, mostly in the 60s, that's a pension fund that was worth maybe $4 billion.
Was that a pension fund also connected with the mob?
That was a pension fund that you better have a friend or you're not going to get a loan. It was notorious. Everyone knows about it. There have been wonderful books written about the subject, including Steve Brill's book, Call the Teamsters. The pension fund was controlled clearly and flat out by the mob. The Central States Pension Fund. There were other pension funds for the Teamsters that were not, incidentally, but the Central States was. And if you wanted to get a loan from Central States, you had to have a friend. And it usually had to be one of the trustees from the pension fund. And these men who came from different cities, they were in Milwaukee, there was one in Milwaukee, there was one in St. Louis, there was in Chicago, there was Cleveland. These men had all been put in place by various organized crime powers in those cities. These were union delegates who had fought within the union and the local battles, quite often with the support of mobsters, to slowly rise within the Teamsters to positions of power.
My guest is Nicholas Pileggi. His new book is called Casino, Love and Honor in Las Vegas. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Nicholas Pileggi is my guest, and we're talking about his new book, Casino, which is about organized crime and Las Vegas in the 70s. Now, he also wrote the screenplay for Martin Scorsese's forthcoming film, Casino. Pileggi is also the author of the bestseller Wise Guys and co-author of the screenplay based on that, Goodfellas, which was also directed by Martin Scorsese. Okay, back to our Vegas story. So Frank Lefty Rosenthal, how much was he involved in legit and in illegitimate activities in Vegas?
Well, he was running the casino. It was a legitimate casino. He was a legitimate man in every way. He had lots of arrests for gambling, but other than that, you would not call Frank Lefty Rosenthal an organized crime figure. People claim, and I think the book shows, that he was clearly associated with these guys, the men who put that casino together, the mob bosses who got the pension fund to lend the front man, a man by the name of Alan Glick, the money to buy these casinos. They would not have allowed a man like Frank Rosenthal to run those places unless they knew him and trusted him. So that's clear. Tony Spilotro was never employed by those casinos. He was an outside power and force. What had happened was that there were four casinos that came up for sale in the early 1970s. And the mobsters, these men who ran the pension fund, said, oh, this is a good deal. Let's grab them. Of course, they cost about $62 million to buy from this corporation that was going to go out of business. The mob guys found a front man, a man by the name of Alan Glick, who was a businessman, a real estate operator. And they said, why don't we give Glick, they talked Glick into doing it. It's all of this, by the way, he's done through lawyers and insurance companies and legitimate people. Glick was told that he would probably be able to borrow $62 million to buy these four casinos if he was interested from the pension fund. He went along with this. The mob guys put the influence on the pension fund to lend him the money. He got the loan in 9 days. This is a man who really did not have any money at all to put up. He had no money really of his own. But he understood a good deal when it came his way, and he was going to take advantage of it, and he did. He took over the casinos. With this, of course, the mob then is able to infiltrate the casinos. It's never some guy in a fedora who meets you on a street corner and says, you got to hire my brother-in-law. It comes through clean ways. One of the things they did was they managed to get their men into what's called the count room of a casino, which is the place where all the money is first counted.
And that's the place where you run the skimming operation.
That's where you run the skimming.
Why don't you explain what a skimming operation is in a casino?
A skimming operation is a place whereby you grab money before it's officially counted, so that if the casino pulls in $1 million over a weekend, you, as somebody with access, you can manage to slip out maybe $300,000 of that million, and eventually the casino will count up $700,000 in profit that weekend. Skimming was put in by people who are in a position to be able to take money out before IRS gets a look at it, before sometimes the proper owners of the place get to look at it. Skimming is something that, it's the blood of Las Vegas.
So Rosenthal ran a skimming operation.
No, he didn't. No, Rosenthal ran the casino. I mean, you see, you can't skim anything unless it makes money. A casino has got to make a lot of money to skim it. If you've got a casino that's got all of these expenses, because they're very expensive places to run, and suddenly you're skimming and there's no money left in the casino, you can't pull that off. Rosenthal's genius was making, maximizing the profit of these places and not interfering to some degree, whether this was conscious, subconscious. However, the people who ran that count room did not deal with Lefty Rosenthal. They were put in there by the mob bosses themselves. Rosenthal could not hire them. Rosenthal couldn't even go into the count room of a casino.
Did you ever go into any of the count rooms when
yes.
you were doing research?
Yes, I've been in them.
Oh, tell us what they're like.
Well, you can only go in them with somebody accompanying you, and you're permitted to go in and you can watch.
I can only imagine they're not going to be on your own.
They're windowless rooms.
Mm-hmm.
The tables all have plastic tops, so you can't slip anything into your pocket under the table. Every casino has a different kind of count room. But what happens is all of the drop boxes, these metal boxes under all of the tables three times a day, are all wheeled into the count room. The money is poured onto tables, broken down into various denominations. That's the paper room. The change room, count room, all the coins are brought in from all the slot machines, the dollar slots, $5 slots, quarter slots, nickels. And they are all weighed. You can't even count that. You just weigh that. And they have hydraulic lifts that lift all this money around. At the Stardust, the casino we're talking about, they stole $7 million in quarters in 1 year.
Wow.
$7 million in quarters. And they did that by jigging the scale in such a way that the Toledo Scale Company scale only weighed two-thirds of what actually went on it. So they knew that one-third of everything that they were weighing they could take out, which is the way they skimmed the coins. That in 1 year, skimming $7 million in quarters, accumulated the weight of that. Just sheer size. I'm just giving you size. It's 146 tons.
Wow.
Of quarters. That's $7 million in quarters. The amounts of money, you would have $100 bills stacked halfway up a wall in bricks. They look like bricks. You would think they were bricks to build a house with. This is the kind of cash that is generated in a functioning, successful casino, like the casinos that Lefty Rosenthal was running, essentially for the men who owned the casinos, who was secretly the mob.
So skimming was the basic way that the mob made their money.
That's
from
right.
Vegas.
That's right. That's the way.
And Frank Lefty Rosenthal, the guy who ran four casinos in Vegas, he didn't run the skimming operation,
no,
but he allowed it to happen.
Well, you know, he was a very smart man. He was a man who was so obsessed with running this place properly, and everyone will give him that. And he was the sort of guy who wound up going into the kitchen, arguing with the chefs in there and ordering that every blueberry muffin have at least 10 blueberries in it. I mean, it turns out that he had gotten a blueberry muffin that had very few blueberries. And another friend of his, actually the owner of the casino, or the ostensible owner, had his blueberry muffin was filled with blueberries. And this was a sort of unthinkable thing as far as Lefty was concerned. And so a man who is that obsessed with running this operation is unlikely not to know what was going on. So that's the major rap on Lefty, was that he knew what was going on and let it happen. And of course, he's still alive, too. So it's that may be why he let it happen.
So while, you know, the main character in your nonfiction book, Frank Lefty Rosenthal, is running the casinos, he has to learn what the operations are that the hustlers use to try to get over on the casinos, you know, to try to,
yes.
to make money illegally. So he learns what all the small-time scams are, which means you learned what all the small-time scams are. So why don't you share some with us?
Well, it's an amazing business. If you think about it, a casino is there, and it's this big pocket of money, and people come from all over the world at their own expense to go there and to see if they can, in a sense, rip off the casino, if they're going to be smarter than the casino, sharper. They're going to beat them at their games. The odds, of course, are very long. But there are other people who go there knowing they're going to skim the casino. They're going to cheat the casino. And you have men who will practice a year and a half in front of a three-way mirror until they're able to deal cards in such a way that they can deal seconds, and they cannot see themselves dealing or cheating in a three-way mirror. And that's when these kinds of men, quite often they're dealers in casinos, will then go and try to rip off the casino. You've got guys, the major people they look to for cheating, of course, are the dealers in the casinos themselves. There's rules, like you cannot have a wristwatch in a casino where the face of the wristwatch is wider than the average chip, because there's a tendency to slip black $100 chips or yellow $1,000 chips under the wristwatch. There are little aprons. You go to the casino, you'll notice the dealers wear little aprons. That's to cover pockets so money can't or chips can't be slid into pockets. They get around that by wearing what they call subs. These are socks that are sewn into the inside of their trousers, and they become so deft with their fingers that they can slide chips into the sock, and then they're hidden away underneath the clothing. The ways of cheating a casino are incredible, that's for the dealers themselves cheating a casino. The outsiders who try to cheat casinos are people called crossroaders. These are professional casino cheats, and they will not only try to cheat on big blackjack games and baccarat games and craps games, but they'll also try to cheat on the slot machines. The typical craps game cheats quite. Sometimes they have help from the inside, better known as the dealers and the pit bosses. Sometimes they don't. What they'll do in some cases is they'll bring somebody in, and somebody will come in with fake dice. They will have the table prepped already. They'll have their own people at that table. The person who rolls what they call the bolognese onto the table, the fake dice onto the table, is usually not someone who plays in the game. It'll be somebody who's just good at rolling dice into a game, and they're gone. Quite often it's a woman. Quite often it's an older woman, somebody who you wouldn't think is even practiced in the art. What happens, a guy like Lefty, what Lefty would do is he would watch these games, and if a guy rolls dice or a woman rolls dice, and at the end of the roll, their entire hand isn't open, so you see all five fingers, you know, just out there, splayed, you've got to worry, because if two fingers are still locked, they could be palming the dice they've rolled two fake dice, and they're palming the other two dice in their hand. Mm-hmm. So every time that happens, they'll watch that hand. If there's a game going on and somebody suddenly spills a drink all over all the chips and the fur coat falls and the pit boss, the box man, instead of looking at that, they're going to look at the dice. No matter what happens, he can blow up a bomb in a casino. That guy's eyes, that's when he really looks at the dice, because that's when he's got to watch out.
You quote Lefty as saying, "I never saw such a business where people were so anxious to give you their money. Give them a free drink and a dream, and they give you their wallets."
That's right. That's what Vegas is about. That's what all of these casinos are about. And to try to figure it out, I've talked to people. I've talked to men in the business, and the real pros don't gamble at all. I mean, they tell me that Meyer Lansky wouldn't bet a dime on anything. And the world is set up. There are people on this side of the table who are the dealers, the professionals, the owners of casinos. And then there are those countless millions on the other side. And we're the smart ones, and they're the suckers. And that's the way, no matter what their ads talk about, that's the way the casino owners and managers look upon their customers. They look upon them basically as suckers.
Nicholas Pileggi is the author of the new book, Casino. He co-wrote the screenplay for Martin Scorsese's film Casino, which will open later this fall. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
When skies are cloudy and gray, they're only gray for a day. So wrap your troubles in dreams, and dream your troubles away. Until that sunshine peeps through, there's only one thing to do, just wrap your troubles in dreams.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second half of our interview with Nicholas Pileggi. His new book, Casino, is about Las Vegas and organized crime in the 70s. Pileggi also co-wrote the screenplay for Martin Scorsese's new film, Casino, which opens later this fall. Pileggi's book, Wise Guy, about life in the lower echelon of the mafia, was the basis of Scorsese's film, Goodfellas. The book Casino is a true story, the result of years of interviews, research through FBI crime files, and, of course, time spent in Vegas. Did you do any gambling while you were researching
Casino?
I
don't gamble. I had to do some. When I was going down there on one occasion, two kids knew I was going. They said, oh, you're going down there? We have saved money, and they had both saved $20. And they wanted me to spend, to gamble $20 for each of them on dollar slot machines. They had this notion that it was going to work. And I had forgotten about it, and I was on my way out, and I remembered that they wanted to, and I said, well, maybe I'll just do it and say that I lost, and then they won it back and give them back the money. But I thought, well, you know, I had promised them I would do it. And what if I did put some money in, and one of them became a millionaire? I mean, how could I not do it for them, even though I knew it was not going to work? So I did it. I was slightly embarrassed. I went and I got two $20 stacks of $20 chips and began putting them in. And this woman, who was the change clerk, gave me the money. And I'm putting them in and putting them in. And all of a sudden, I felt a tap on my shoulder. And it was the change clerk. She came over and she's, Mister, she said, Mister. I said, yes, she's, Mister, you're supposed to be having a good time. So I understood that, my inner workings were obviously showing on my face.
Well, no, I'll tell you, I went to Atlantic City once and went into a couple of gambling casinos there. I mean, really out of curiosity, mm-hmm. and also to see a performer that evening at one of the nightclubs. But anyways, it was really grim inside.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a lot of, you know, I'm used to the gambling movies and the Monte Carlo movies where it's women in evening gowns and guys in suits and tuxedos. And these are like people in... Well, they get jeans and T-shirts.
Yes, spandex, a lot of spandex.
Yeah, a lot of spandex. And everybody looked really depressed and very desperate.
Yes.
And it was kind of like an assembly line, you know, put in the quarter, pull the lever, put in the quarter, pull the lever with grim determination. There was I saw no pleasure.
Now, I think that's an interesting and very astute observation. I think in the 60s, when Lefty started, and during the 60s and that whole period, there was... At least there was a certain panache. There was a style. There was money to be made, and some guys, everybody lost it, of course. But there was fun. They were having fun at the same time, and there was a lot of money around. It was described at the time as black money, and that lasted from the 50s into the 60s. Black money was money that was made during the war from the black market. It was unreportable income. Lots and lots and lots of people had it. And they would go to Vegas and just throw it away. It didn't matter. They could never report it. They couldn't buy six houses, you know, without it calling attention to themselves. So it was almost free money. That began to change. And also, you got to remember, the casinos were small. When you went into a casino in the 60s, they knew your name. It's Mr. R. It's Miss Jean. It's how are you? It's good to see you again. You want your regular room. That's a Campari on the rocks without the lime. Is that, you know, that's the way it was. In those days, you went to your room. You didn't wait on a line like you were checking into an airport. Your room today, you got to wait for your room. In those days, you went to your room. It's a different place. When Benny Siegel opened the Flamingo, it was 146 rooms. Today, the MGM Grand is 5,005 rooms. I mean, you order room service, you're lucky you get it on Thursday. I mean, it's a totally different kind of economic scale. And the intimacy and the fun and the ring-a-ding and the Frank Sinatra and the, you know, and the Don Rickles and the showrooms, it's all over. And they've got these vast malls that are shopping mall things that they're just churning out, and people are grim. They're joyless places. I'm not talking morally or anything. They're just no fun.
No, but Vegas is this big family place now, right? It's a bring the kids kind of place.
Yeah, it's bring the kids and lose the college money. I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. Well, that's it, you know, because there's no, what are you doing there? I mean, you're just losing money. I don't know how long the boom is going to last. They're trying to turn it into and I guess in a way they're right. It's this vast business. There's millions and millions of people depending upon it, raising kids, and it's perfectly fine. And people like to go and gamble and make, you know they're going to lose. But if they win once in a while, it's fun too. And if they lose, who cares? You know, that's part of your expendable weekend or money for the holiday. I'm going to go to Vegas. It's going to cost us X number of the thousands to fly and to get a room. And we'll lose $1,000 gambling. That's what we'll do. And we'll just have a good time and spend 4 days and come home. And if by some miracle something happens where we win, that's just even nicer. So given that mentality, that's fine. It's another thing for people to do. And there's certainly a very exciting element in gambling. But the other part, the old Vegas, where people knew you and you knew them, and that's all over. That's gone.
Let me get back to the story that you tell in your book, Casino. And this is, again, getting back to Vegas in the 70s. The main person who you write about, Frank Lefty Rosenthal, eventually lost his gaming license. What happened?
Well, what happened was that this book tells the story of the bridge that ended the old Las Vegas, the explosion that really put an end to it, and comes out the other end of the new Las Vegas. What had happened was when Lefty and Tony and Lefty's wife, Jerry, and all of these people were running Las Vegas, to a certain point they were, it was a happy place, and there was a lot of money to be made, and these people were living lives you could not believe. It was all fantasy, and it all went to everyone's head. Lefty really began to think that he was the biggest man in the world, let alone Las Vegas. He worked hard, but he enjoyed it. His wife spent money beyond belief. Tony Spilotro began to think in terms of taking over the mob all over the world. The power in that town that they had and the money they had was inexhaustible. You go from there, that world of joy and wealth and power, to where everyone goes a little screwy resentments begin to build. And there's the betrayals.
Well, speaking of betrayals, we'll save the story of the car bombing and the murder and so on for your book and for the movie. Lefty left Vegas in 83 after the attempt on his life through the car bombing. And yes. You say that this was the end of an era. What changed at about that time?
Well, one of the things that changed was that the Teamsters Pension Fund was no longer the only source of revenue. You no longer had to go to the Teamsters to buy a casino, and as a result, the mob bosses who controlled the pension fund at the Teamsters were no longer in a position to dictate who went into the count room. And as a result, they had lost their power in Las Vegas. Public corporations came in. Instead of going to the Teamsters for money, suddenly they were able to go to Michael Milken at Drexel Burnham. And the new way you're able to take over casinos today are junk bonds. Junk bonds own the casino industry today. These places are churning a lot of money out, but they're also paying 19% and 20% interest on those debts. The Teamsters never charged anything remotely like that for interest on the debts. And I might point out also, the Teamsters Union, the pension fund holder, the guy who has to depend upon that pension fund, they never lost a nickel on any casino investment they ever made. They always made money for their employees and the workers. So that's sort of like a little added irony to this whole notion. One would think, oh, the mobsters got the pension fund and taking all the money from the hard workers. That's not true.
How clean would you say Vegas is now?
Oh, I think it's to sanitize to a degree where it's probably very little fun. I think it's very clean. And the ownership is the power of a casino, and the power of the industry is the owners. Who really controls and owns the casino? The law, by the way, was changed in Nevada a few years ago, so that public corporations now can own casinos. So you see Marriott is there, and Hilton, and ITT. I mean, this is what's happened. The men with the fedoras are long gone. But the world the underworld, the netherworld, still exists to a great degree. There is the labor racketeering that still goes on. There's corruption of various levels. There's bookmaking. Because, you know, you go to a casino for bookmaking, sometimes a guy's tapped out. He can't gamble in a casino anymore. His credit line is gone. Well, he goes down the street and he gambles with a guy who will give him the credit. He will come and take it in kind some other day. But there are mob guys who are loan sharking. There's narcotics in the town. The wise guys take care of a lot of that stuff, or they oversee it. So one hesitates to say that they have wiped the mob is gone, but the mob is gone on the level that it once existed, and that was as the owners or the de facto owners of the casino industry.
My guest is Nicholas Pileggi, author of the new book, Casino. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Nicholas Pileggi, author of the new book Casino, Love and Honor in Las Vegas. He also co-wrote the screenplay for Martin Scorsese's new film Casino, which opens later this fall. So the movie stars De Niro, Joe Pesci, and Sharon Stone.
Yes.
Did you write the dialogue with them in mind?
No. I hadn't finished the book when we were working on the movie. I was still in the process of gathering the book. And when Bob and Frank got together, and when I got together with Bob and Frank, De Niro asks the kinds of questions where Frank began going into things that emotionally troubled him, that he was able to discuss of a personal nature. I mean, I'm there as a police reporter, an old crime reporter. I'm there asking the Jack Webb question. And then suddenly I'm in a room with De Niro and Rosenthal, and De Niro is asking these fascinating questions.
Like what? Do you remember any?
Well, just the kinds of things about relationships and where did you want to go from there? What did she say? And did you feel? And what was she? You know, that kind of stuff. He was asking the emotional questions behind the decisions that Lefty made.
The what are my motivation questions.
Exactly. And the other thing is, of course, that Bob is very, very smart, and Frank is too, and they really began to move this thing together. Well, I'm just sitting there taking notes like mad, of course, as this thing goes on, and all of that stuff then began to accumulate itself in the book. Questions he didn't necessarily answer. Well, he answered all of them to me, but provoked by thoughts that perhaps I might not have ever thought, avenues I might not have ever thought to go down. Is that a clear way of saying it?
Yeah. No, it was a similar process working with Scorsese on the screenplay. Does he lead you in directions you wouldn't have thought of going down?
Yes, because he'll ask questions that I might not have thought of asking. He's a stickler for the truth of, you know, what really, because motive comes out of truth and character comes out of truth. And even if you're dealing with fictional characters or fictionalized characters or dramatizations of the reality, it's the reality we have to dramatize. Not something fake, and he has an extraordinary talent for being able to smell out the fake, and that was tremendous guidance, clearly for the screenplay, but also for the book, because I had these two guys who were, you know, obviously with their own agendas. I mean, Marty's looking to do the movie and Bob is looking to play the part, but they were enormous help to me in keeping my little boat focused.
Now, I know that Alan King, Don Rickles, Steve Allen all have parts in the film. Do they play entertainers?
Steve Allen is seated in Joe Pesci's restaurant, and indeed the Joe Pesci character is based on, Tony Spilotro, did have a restaurant. And Steve Allen was there at the time, and he sort of is in the restaurant with his wife, Jane Meadows, who was kind enough to trot out a dress she wore back in the 70s at this time that was, it's all sequenced, and it is the Queen of Diamonds, all in sequences. And this is the clothes that people wore during that period. We all remember the 70s because they seem as though they were yesterday, but it's an amazing period in costume, in color, in hairstyles, in music.
So you started to write Casino, and then Scorsese decided he wanted to make a film based on it?
Yes. What had happened was we had been talking in the meantime. You know, after Goodfellas, we were talking about doing another project, and we started on one. And then he knew I was working on Casino because we talked. We're friends. You know, and what are you doing? Well, I'm doing this. And what are you doing? I'm doing that. And he was he was going to be directing Clockers. And our plan was for him to finish directing Clockers while I wrote Casino. And then when Clockers was finished, Casino would be out. He and I would then sit down with the book and see what happens when with a director like Marty, anyway, is he would then take the book and go away. I mean, go into his apartment or into his house. And he would read the book and visualize the film of this book and how he might go about it. And then he and I would sit down and we would lay that structure out because, you know, a book is 340 pages. A screenplay should be about 110, 120. But he called one day and he said, I've decided I'm not going to direct Clockers. I think Spike Lee wants to direct it. And Marty produced it, and Spike and he are very good friends. And so he said, but that means I don't have a thing. I have a window. I don't have a project. How is Casino doing? I said, Marty, I haven't even written it. I'm working on it. He said, well, we both know the story. And indeed he did. He said, why don't we do the screenplay first? And then when I'm writing doing the movie, you do the book. I said, all right, let's do it that way. And so that's the way we did it.
That's so strange because you did the fictionalized version before doing the real version.
Yes, except this is a fictionalized version that you'll see is not all that fictionalized.
Right. Now, I have to ask you one question before we let you go.
Sure.
About Goodfellas, which was the movie that you co-wrote based on your nonfiction book, Wise Guys. Now, Wise Guys was based on someone in the Witness Protection Program.
Yes.
Is he still alive? Are you still
Henry?
In touch with him?
Yeah. Yes, no, he's still alive. Every once in a while I hear from him.
It must be killing him that he's in the Witness Protection Program and he can't kind of cash in on this newfound celebrity.
Well, I don't know how he deals with it. It was, I think, very difficult at the time when he would be able to look up and see posters of Ray Liotta playing him. I don't know, he's at least alive and none of his friends are. And I think he must be able to take some satisfaction in that.
So how's he doing?
I don't know. You don't know what, it's not really smart to ask. And he's, occasionally I'll just hear from him and he'll just call to say hello and that all's going well. And I hope all is going well for him.
Okay.
It's a mysterious world.
One other thing I wanted to ask you. Was it hard to get the person who you focus on in Casino to cooperate with you and tell you the story of his life?
It was impossible. It took me years. He refused to talk. He refused to talk for years. I flew halfway around the country all the time to talk to his lawyer, Oscar Goodman. I flew all over the place, and I'd spend time with him trying to get him to convince Frank to talk to me. I then wound up doing all of the research. Spent months in the federal archives, talked to lawyers, got all the wiretap information, had everything you could possibly have, and then went to the lawyers and said, look, I've got all of this stuff. I've interviewed all of his friends. Will he at least answer questions? And well, that's what took a couple of years, just to get to Frank. He finally conceded and agreed to answer questions just so that I would not perpetuate a lot of the myth and the garbage that had been printed about him. And that's the way we started. And he was true to his word, I have to say that. He was a gentleman and courteous and hated being interviewed. Is not the kind of man who was looking forward to any of this. It's very, very painful stuff for him. It only began to open up a little bit, I have to admit, when De Niro showed up. And then I think he began to see that we weren't really looking to hurt him or to pillory him or to write the kinds of stuff that appeared in the past that was basically all geared in a destructive way, that we were really trying to find out the truth of a fascinating period. And then he helped. He helped tremendously, as you will know by reading the book.
Well, Nicholas Pileggi, thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Nicholas Pileggi is the author of the new book Casino. He co-wrote the screenplay for Martin Scorsese's film Casino, which will open later this fall. Coming up, the film scores of Ennio Morricone. This is Fresh Air. Italian composer Ennio Morricone has scored over 200 films since the 1960s, from the Battle of Algiers to Bugsy. But he's probably best known for his soundtracks to Sergio Leone's Italian westerns of the 60s, including The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and Once Upon a Time in the West. Several new Morricone collections are out on CD. Critic Kevin Whitehead has an appreciation.
Ah! That's Ennio Morricone's theme from Navajo Joe, a 1966 spaghetti western starring Burt Reynolds. The theme was so over the top, it wasn't even used. In the 60s and 70s especially, Morricone had a knack for appropriate musical hysteria. He could pump up a bad movie, or one that just looked dumb, like Exorcist II, The Heretic, the one where James Earl Jones dresses up as a grasshopper. One Morricone trademark is unconventional use of the voice, which is as likely to giggle or belch as sing a melody. He's big on whistling, too, so his fixation is really about the mouth, which can make music without the aid of an instrument. This tack is psychologically shrewd. It adds a human dimension that makes even seedy exploitation fare seem more authentic. His scores relate to the movies on their own level. He reinforces Navajo Joe's raw male energy, and Exorcist II's 70s view of evil as a bad acid trip with the Doors. It's no accident Morricone's most memorable work was for the great Sergio Leone. He underscored Leone's wide-open landscapes where anything can happen. That comes through even in the way the music is mixed, with some instruments in close-up, some in the distance, and something bizarre always lurking at the edges. Spaghetti westerns were a riot of anachronisms, stylistic clashes, and messy grotesqueries that fit Ennio Morricone like a saddle. He'd think like an audacious director, making weird juxtapositions. He'd take you straight from Marlboro Man cliches to psychedelic effects that parallel what the Beatles were up to at the same time. This was 1966, the same era as Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane. As with most aspects of movie making, the composer relied on sympathetic collaborators. Morricone in his prime had his stock company of striking players, chief among them whistler and guitarist Alessandro Alessandroni. It's hard to imagine what Morricone's early music would sound like if he hadn't known a good whistler. Anyway, among the recent spate of Morricone reissues is a 2-CD set from DRG called An Ennio Morricone Western Quintet. It contains 5 soundtracks, including his gloriously stupid score for My Name is Nobody. The music we've been hearing comes from Rhino's irresistible 2-CD Morricone box, A Fistful of Film Music. It's a representative grab bag of classics, romantic schmaltz, highly uneven rock, and nonsense too terrible not to like, such as Joan Baez singing The Ballad of Sacco and Vanzetti. Morricone soundtracks can be uninspired, especially these days, but the earlier, daffier ones remain classic.
Kevin Whitehead is currently in Amsterdam researching a book on Dutch jazz. He reviewed A Fistful of Film Music, the new CD box set of Ennio Morricone music on Rhino. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman and Audrey Bentham. We've had help this week from Tina Brock. Alan Tu and Roberta Sherrock directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.